immediately, Lynch and Frost, create this property that we are instantly loyal to.
You know, if there is going to be a season four, Michael Ancine and Vera Flynn Boyle are still alive. David Lynch, do what you got to do, man. Work your magic.
Electricity was sizzling away from the very start. So energy and power have been causing trouble all along. And so has Bob.
Laura is filled with secrets. And it was always supposed to end like this.
Hello again, dear listeners and friends. And welcome back to Back to the Double R, where we have come full circle back to the very beginning of our journey as we discuss the pilot, or in this instance, really kind of also the international version of the pilot episode of Twin Peaks. We are so glad we are returning to the very first episode of this series and hope you guys come along with us and enjoy the ride. My name is Jonathan, and my air sacs have never felt so good.
I'm Colin, and it's happy hour in France.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jennifer, and welcome to the Killer's Lair.
And I'm Damon, and what goes around comes around.
What year is this? Why, it's February 1989, 11:30 a.m. to be exact. And yes, Laura Palmer is dead, wrapped in plastic. The whole damn town of Twin Peaks seems to be in collective mourning upon the discovery of the murdered homecoming queen. Some folks are in histrionics, others are blasé, and James Hurley is just one very sad boy alone with his motorcycle. The 11:30 a.m. arrival of Special Agent Dale Cooper into Twin Peaks gets the ball rolling on the investigation. He meets the locals, examines Laura's body, whittles, and most importantly, strikes up a partnership with Sheriff Harry S. Truman, the lawman in charge of the investigation. Despite a few promising leads, Cooper checks into a clean and reasonably priced room at the Great Northern Hotel. Back at the Palmer home, Sarah Palmer has a vision of a hand grabbing the most important clue left behind, half of the heart necklace that belonged to Laura Palmer. But wait, that's not what happens here. Sarah has a vision of Killer Bob in Laura's room. Deputy Hawk makes a sketch. Agent Cooper receives a phone call from Mike. He and Sheriff Truman meet Mike at Calhoun Memorial, where he recites the Fire Walk With Me poem, and they find Bob in corporeal form. Mike shoots and kills Bob, who is the murderer. That night, Agent Cooper has a strange dream.
Okay, folks, so we are returning to the pilot. Just a few brief details, written by Mark Frost and David Lynch, directed by David Lynch. Originally aired on the ABC network on April 8th, 1990. And, you know, there was a huge phenomenon, 35 plus million viewers. And the reason we have an international version of Twin Peaks is sort of part of the agreement for getting the funding for filming the pilot. You know, there was some questions on, hey, you know, is this going to get picked up for an entire series? And if you've seen the rest of the series, when you watch Traces to Nowhere, clearly they did, but it was, you know, some time between those two episodes. So as sort of a fail safe, you know, the money demanded of Frost and Lynch that they come up with the conclusion to the mystery of who killed Laura Palmer. Because, hey, if it didn't get picked up, they could go ahead and put this version of the story into movie theaters and, you know, make back some of their investments. This was actually shown in, you know, theaters if you went to Europe or Japan or other places. However, it is considered, or at least, you know, the ending. And, you know, basically once we get to that part with Sarah Palmer at home is sort of when the ending for the international version kicks in. And all of that is considered non-canonical information at this point in time. It's certainly not something that I think Lynch and Frost themselves considered properly part of the story, but I do think it is, you know, kind of a fun little diversion. And I do remember watching this as a kid, because you could like rent a VHS back in those times, right? Where, you know, you had like this version of the story. So, you know, this is before you could just watch any old show on streaming forever and ever, right? So, you know, for many, many people, this was the introduction into the story and probably caused a lot of confusion when you went and watched the other episodes and you're like, wait, I've already seen the Red Room dream. Wait, like Leland is the killer and not Bob? I think to avoid confusion, they decide, this is not really what the story is and the rest is what the story is. However, I might make an argument that we can put the international version back into proper Twin Peaks canon, but we'll get to that when I, talk a bit on my section. I also found a couple of really neat pieces of trivia that are about the pilot. One, I'm considering that the end of the international version takes place at Calhoun Memorial. I guess Mark Frost took the name Calhoun from his maternal grandmother. And his maternal grandmother would tell him stories about a woman named Hazel Drew, who was a 20-year-old governess, and her body washed ashore in New York City in July of 1908. That murder is still unsolved and was sort of Frost's, inspiration for, Laura Palmer, having sort of a, mystery of a dead girl that floated up in a town, sort of kicking off the whole thing. That's where he sort of, got that little bit from. So the hospital is named after his grandmother. The other bit that I found that I thought was, a really interesting piece of trivia and just shows how, things sort of change from conception to final form. I guess Audrey Horne had no dialogue whatsoever, was sort of completely silent. But Lynch fell in love with her in terms of her performance and the way she sort of brought that character to life. So, a lot of little seeds and things you can tell from this very first episode that sometimes went on to become, larger plot points and other things that may have been dismissed. So I think, really interesting sort of how this was sort of birthed into the world and for us to enjoy as fans of Twin Peaks.
Well, I enjoyed going back to the pilot tremendously, of course. I enjoyed the weird alternate universe ending, of course. There were so many emotions that you get when you are watching, having seen the whole thing. It's a very different sort of ball game. It's really quite dramatic. At least that's how it felt for me. But I actually want to just focus on the first few sequences and sort of what stood out to me. I mean, there were a lot of wonderful things from characters who we get to see a great deal from. Like, I love Lucy's introduction, the famous introduction where she is telling Harry that, he has a call on this table with this lamp, not that chair, the other chair. And she's got her big headset on. It's really fun to rewatch and realize things like Andy starts crying at the scene of the body washing up. He starts crying before he even knows who it is. Little touches like that come out when you are watching again. And so, Damon, I know you've rewatched many times, and I know that it continues to, render up fascinating little details. So I'm sort of eager to, start my rewatch of the rewatch or something like that. There are a couple of deeper things that I think we'll get into. I think it's really fascinating, for example, that both Sarah and Leland are having these intense reactions, these soap opera reactions to news of their daughter's death. And, it is impossible to know, having gone all the way through the return, whether any of that is actually Bob or Judy. Whether or not it is or is not or is conceived as such, you can't help but ask that question. Is Sarah crying because she lost the chance to manipulate Laura? Is Leland you know, actually being possessed by Bob, and is Bob doing his big faking act? So there are some of those deep things too that are really fun in the rewatch. The thing that really stood out to me though was in Lynch and Frost's storytelling. And it was amazing to me to see how little it takes to really be distinctive, to create something weird with just a few little lines of dialogue in these first, you know, 15 to 20 minutes of the show. Lynch and Frost immediately create this property that we are, you know, instantly loyal to. And, you know, it's small things, like a line of dialogue, or like the scream of somebody running through the school courtyard. You know, there are these little touches. I know that in our original conversation, we talked about the amazing scene with the principal, and it's just these little performances. They call out that this show is different, that these characters are different. And I was frankly, you know, for a show that we all think of as shattering norms, I was amazed at how little it took in these opening sequences to create something that we were immediately in love with. Just a little weirdness, a little comedy. And so I would be interested to hear from my co-hosts what they thought about those opening sequences. And did they, you know, do you feel that the show was telegraphing its idiosyncrasies, or does it not even really project how weird it's going to get? It's kind of both at the same time. It's really like seeing multiple shows at once. What did you think?
There are things that I've seen the pilot probably more times than any other episode, because that is something I've returned to even during our podcast. I've gone back and watched bits and pieces of it. And some of the things that struck me on this rewatch are also those little things that you're mentioning. And, you know, like the scene with the telephone, when we hear Sarah Palmer on the other side of the telephone as she's realizing that Laura is dead. And the way that whole scene is cut, you know, it cuts back and forth between, like, you know, the camera's panning down the phone and we see the receiver and we hear her screaming. And then I think we see her screaming. And then there's another scene where it goes from like a phone sound to the falls, and then it blends together. So I think, you know, we've talked a lot about sound, and I think sound is something that is evident maybe in these examples that I'm giving, that I think makes the show stand apart from some other shows. Just, you know, how unique that must have felt to me at the time to be seeing scenes like the dangling phone with somebody screaming at the other end. It's amazing and chilling. And yeah, it marks that this is entirely different television.
So I took this opportunity to show the pilot to my kids. So if you ever want to know, like, you know, like, do we think something is weird or like normal or abnormal or whatever, show something to your kids, because they'll, you know, give you like the honest answers. I showed it a little late, but it got like, you know, like late in the day. But we had two kind of reactions to my daughters that I think kind of like, you know, tell you everything you need to know. One, my 9-year-old fell asleep. So, like, that's not surprising, because like the show is slow, and it doesn't, like, it, you know, for as much like crying and like, you know, sort of the big emotions that are there at the beginning, it's still quiet, right? It's not like a loud show. You know, we've been watching Stranger Things season 4, which is definitely a loud show, right? There's, you know, there's giant monsters, there's pop music, there's, you know, outsized performances. So, you know, like, I don't think my kids were quite used to something that was like so lugubrious and so like just, you know, taking its time with details. I'm like, my older daughter, Juliet, she was a little bit more into the story, and she's been kind of like, you know, biting at the edges and will ask me things, but she picked up on stuff like, you know, like the boogeyman, right? Like the guy at the high school who's like dancing, or like when the girl is like, you know, screaming, she's like, "Daddy, that's weird. I don't understand that." Right. Like, so there was a lot of like, you know, stuff that like definitely like jumps out as like still strange to this day. Right. I mean, and they've never explained like, you know, why the kid, you know, kind of does his little sachet and the boogie, which, you know, just that sticks out is like totally weird. Right. But like, it is really fun going back to it, especially with the knowledge of, you know, 48 episodes of Twin Peaks. Like, I always like, you know, I had to, you know, tell my kid why, I danced around the fact why I thought it was so funny that like Bobby and like the, you know, the deputies are so antagonistic toward each other, when we know full well that they all become, you know, kind of like our heroes, right? Like Bobby becomes one of those boys, right? And you know, yet, you know, Hawk is giving him a hard time, and like Andy's looking at him sideways, and you know, Truman's having none of his crap. You know, there are really fun things to like go back and realize that like, oh, like, you know, 48 episodes from now, you're going to think this is hilarious. And just the show does a really good job of like putting all the pieces together, even right there from its inception. They had a very, very strong foundation that was able to, you know, take the show in really any direction like it could have wanted. And I mean, we have two very distinct endings here, right? So, you know, bravo to Frost and Lynch, as always.
Yeah, I would say to your question, Colin, that the show very definitely telegraphs that it's doing something different right from the get-go. And there are several things that stand out to me, a couple of which we've already touched on. But a lot of it can be summed up in a comment that a friend of mine made when I showed the pilot episode to them for the first time. And they said, "That's just not how people behave." and it isn't. And I mean, there's the obvious examples like the dancing kid in the hallway, right? But there's also just the way people speak, the pacing is unnatural. And there's something about it that just makes you immediately feel like you're in a dream world or something. It's just, that's just not how people talk. That's just not how people act. To that, I would add the music, especially at the time this was made, there wasn't another TV show that had music that sounded like this. I mean, it's so ahead of its time. Frankly, a lot of it sounds more like, you know, the like intro notes of like a goth band or something than it sounds like a television soundtrack. I mean, the only thing I can compare it to, which is very different, but I think equally distinctive, is Doctor Who, the 60s and 70s Doctor Who, which has also like a really surreal kind of score to it. And then last but not least, you know, similarly, I think related to this pacing issue that I was just talking about, is just the way that Lynch uses shots of inanimate objects. You know, normally in a television show, if there's like a long establishing shot that's supposed to set a mood, it's on a person looking sad or something like that. It's not on a lamp or a fan or a tree. And the fact that we just kind of linger with these objects, and I know we've talked about this before, one, it kind of imbues some of these objects with a weight, and in some cases sort of a sinister feeling. But it also just makes you kind of stop and feel what they're laying down, and think about what is happening in a way that you just don't have time for in a show like Stranger Things, which again, I'm not knocking Stranger Things. I'm midway through the fourth season, thoroughly enjoying it, but you don't have time to stop and think about stuff. It's just throwing stuff at you constantly, right? Here, we're just going to like stop and look at a lamp for 3 seconds. And it, you know, it gives your brain time to sort of ask questions about what's happening.
You know, but I do think like, you know, people do like people don't behave like this in real life, but yet like they put enough moments of like, wait, that is actually how people behave in real life. Like I'm thinking again of like the high school scene, like, you know, where they show like Donna just, you know, she's crying and crying, and they show James and like, they don't want to, you know, kind of, you know, lead on that they have the relationship, but then they have this little scene where there's like four of Donna's friends that are like, they're kind of giving her comfort. And I mean, I remember, you know, when there was, you know, tragedies that, you know, happened in, you know, my high school, and, you know, you would see kind of people like, you know, hugging them like in the hallways. And like, you know, I think like when like Lucy tells Andy, it's, you know, he's like okay for, you know, having his emotions, like that's, I think, also something that's, you know, really recognizable. So, you know, they do like just this masterful job of like balancing the weird and like the completely normal at the same time. So I didn't really come up with a theme here. I mean, I'm still, you know, pretty heavy on like, hey, you know, this, you know, the pilot episode introduces sort of like, you know, the concept of like grief and trauma and how, you know, those things affect like, you know, individuals and then a community as a whole. And then, well, you know, as we move further and further in Twin Peaks, perhaps like it has, you know, global and even cosmic implications, right? So yeah, I think that's still, you know, really, you know, what we, you know, get out of this episode, right? Is that, okay, like, you know, look at how this one horrible event kind of, you know, changes the course of everyone's lives here. So, you know, what I'd like to kind of take advantage of in our discussion here is to maybe, you know, sort of bring up some regrets or like missed opportunities from the pilot that we like really didn't get a chance to like kind of dive into. Cause I went and I, you know, listened to our very first episode of our podcast and I'm like, ah, you know, we even kind of changed it a little bit too, as we kind of went on. Right. So, you know, one thing that I put in my mind frame here was to sort of treat International Pilot, not like episode one, but it's episode 49, right? What year is this? Why? It's 1989 and it's another 1989. And the phrase another 1989 is also what some of the fan base uses to describe what we saw at the end of part 18, where Cooper becomes Richard, right? And, you know, they meet Carrie Page. Like, so like some people consider that to be another 1989. And like in Final Dossier, when we just read, right, where they talk about how, you know, Leland kills himself on February 24th, 1990, also part of like another 1989. So, I mean, it's firmly established at this point that Twin Peaks has created alternate universes. So, you know, why not just have this be episode 49, which is like a little bit different. And it is, you know, it's kind of neat to think of it from that regard, especially with like the Sarah Palmer aspect where she's, you know, says Laura and you're like, oh, is that what Carrie Page is hearing? You know, so you can like, it's kind of so seamlessly, like seems like the next place to go when we finish with like 48. And I guess, you know, kind of really the only difference here is that, you know, in the International Pilot, you know, we get an alternate universe, but one in which a tidy ending is given to a naughty mystery. And sort of, you know, my take on, you know, that last little bit, it's like, it's sort of the cinematic equivalent of a rice cake, right? A bunch of empty calories and filled with hot air, right? So, you know, I don't know if like, this is really kind of like what Frost and Lynch wanted. You can kind of feel like, oh, they're like holding their noses as they like film kind of like this last little bit and a tacked on ending to sort of, you know, make, you know, one slice of the story palatable for, you know, audiences that might not have the opportunity to see all, you know, 48 episodes. So, you know, so really, you know, what I enjoyed best was seeing how well the puzzle pieces like fit together. You know, we know that they never intended to solve the mystery, but it's fascinating to see all the, you know, the breadcrumbs. Like, cause I mean, and I still think that Frost and Lynch must have known that like Leland was the killer at this point. I mean, cause we, you know, spent a lot of the first part of the show looking for like Bob clues, and you can get him here, right? Like when he is at the Great Northern and you can see like kind of Truman coming in from the window, and, you know, Ray Wise kind of like gets a glimpse of Truman coming in, and you can like see his face change from like grief to like sort of like steel, right? Like, you know, the gears are turning in there. And, you know, they must have had it edited, and, you know, Dwayne Dunham, who edited this, like won an Emmy for his work, you know, because I don't think at that point they told Ray Wise, but they might have like clued it in like, hey, maybe like make this guy's motivations ambiguous. Right. So there's a lot of that like fun, like ambiguity where you can be like, oh, they must have had like, you know, the genesis for like what the end of the story was going to be, you know, here, right? Or like the part where like they're in Laura's bedroom and Leland tries to stop Hawk from taking the diary. I'm like, oh man, that came into play like, you know, hugely later. So, you know, it's just, you know, you see sort of their mastery you know, at display. And even in the international version, right, there's a part where like Leland is calling Lucy, and I'm like, he's still covering for Bob at this point, right? There's, you know, you could easily read into it that way. So, you know, it's just a marvel, like how well, you know, some of these scenes fit together, or like in like the scene where like James and Donna are talking together, you can tell that like Lynch and Bob Engels must have like just, you know, reverse engineered like kind of the whole part we see in Fire Walk With Me from sort of the bits in that conversation. But I guess, you know, kind of the thing that stuck with me the most, and we didn't have a ton of time for this in our initial pod, was sort of the relationship between Agent Cooper and Sheriff Truman. And I think in a lot of ways, like Sheriff Truman is kind of like the main character of this episode, because, you know, he's in like the first half a lot, right? Because, you know, he's there when they find the, or he's not there right when they find the body, but, you know, as soon as Pete makes the phone call, right, there's, you know, Sheriff Truman is on the scene, and, you know, you like, you know, Truman is kind of like the audience stand in, right? You know, we get to go with him from like, you know, place to place. And as sort of like the, you know, the mystery unfolds, you know, he's sort of the audience surrogate, right? But, you know, what's really cool is like when Cooper is brought in, you know, he's the wild card, right? So like, it's like, you know, like a lot of people think Cooper's the straight man and kind of everything else that happens in Twin Peaks is, you know, sort of the wild cards. But in this relationship, you know, Agent Cooper is sort of the, you know, the chaos agent, or the, you know, the, you know, the guy who's unpredictable. And so, you know, what I really like about it, and what I've always liked, is sort of that first scene at Calhoun Memorial where they go to, you know, look at the body, and, you know, they take the time to like, you know, Cooper pulls him aside. He's like, well, hey, look, you know, we've had, you know, bits of trouble with law enforcement before, and, you know, like another sort of extrapolation, right? Because you see that in Fire Walk With Me, where, you know, Desmond and, you know, the Deer Metal yokels were, you know, fighting. But here Cooper's like, no, you know, I want to make sure, you know, we have a partnership. And Truman is receptive to that. He's like, yeah, dude, totally. I'm in over my head here, right? And like, kind of as you like watch the episode, like their relationship is really the key. Like there's the scene where, you know, they're going through the diary, and Cooper rips it open and he finds the cocaine and, you know, all the other stuff. And he's like, and Truman calls him Mr. Cooper at that point, right? Almost like he lost a little respect for him. And, you know, Truman says something like, well, you know, you didn't know Laura Palmer. And like a lesser writer, you know, would have had Cooper say, oh, well, you didn't know her either. But what does Cooper say? He's like, well, let's go to the morgue and find out what we didn't know about Laura Palmer together, right? So already, like, you know, he's building up like something that's inclusive. And so when, you know, by the time you get like Cooper and Truman in the squad car at night, and like they're in there a lot, and, you know, Cooper's like, oh, well, you know what you do in a town like this? And, you know, Truman's like, all right, you know, you got me hook, line, and sinker. He's like, oh, well, you do whittling. So, you know, we've said before, like, how compassion is like sort of a huge like point of this show. And I think even here at the very beginning, with the relationship between these two men, Lynch kind of goes out of his way to establish, you know, that principle of the show. You know, it's kind of hidden, you know, in how those guys interact. So I guess, you know, my question to you guys is, what are some of the things that like either like jumped out at you, you know, when you did this rewatch, or, you know, what was something maybe that like got totally wrecked by, you know, seeing, you know, the ending? You know, what are some of the things that stuck out in your guys' mind when we, you know, returned to the pilot episode here?
Well, I'll jump in. I mean, one thing that really struck me was just seeing everybody look so young again. I mean, even as compared to the end of season two, everybody just looks so like young and fresh in this episode. And nobody knows quite yet the journey that they're all about to go on, which is just kind of like exciting to see all of our beloved characters just at the outset of this amazing journey that they're all about to go on. I will definitely second what you said about Cooper and Truman. I mean, to me, the absence of Harry Truman from season three is maybe the thing that is most disappointing about it. Not that Frank doesn't do a great job. You know, he's an admirable stand-in, but, you know, there's a tragedy to the fact that these two like friends that are, you know, that build such an important relationship together over the course of the first two seasons never get to be reunited. And I mean, I think it's kind of sad for us as fans that we don't get to see that, but in the narrative itself, there's also just something, especially as we read about in the, you know, the Mark Frost books, how Harry sort of like never gave up looking for Cooper and, you know, kind of held that friendship close to his heart, you know, for the rest of his life. The fact that we don't get to see them reunite is, I don't know, having that would have brought a nice sort of symmetry to this story that, you know, it's unfortunate we don't get, I think.
Yeah, it's really interesting to watch the pilot again, because you think of everything that we do see later. You know, you're thinking about, you know, Cooper's going to meet these gangsters and, you know, Major Briggs is going to turn up in a somewhat incomplete fashion and, you know, all these things. But you also, you also think about characters who you're going to lose in that transition. For me, Pete is a big one, like mm-hmm. the fact that we couldn't come back to Pete. But also, and I was sort of surprised by how much I thought this upon seeing the pilot, not having Donna anywhere in the return. I wasn't thinking about it in the moment while we were recording all these, you know, 18 episodes. But when I saw the pilot and I, saw how important she is in those early moments, and that reminded me of how important she is through both of the first two seasons, that really stood out to me, that was kind of a shame that didn't work. I mean, it's incredible how much did come together, but that one was what I was missing.
Yeah, I really enjoyed seeing Donna in this episode, in the pilot too, Colin, and also seeing her sister Harriet. And
yeah,
I think throughout all of Twin Peaks, I wish that we had seen more of that family. It was kind of like the missing sisters, you know.
Yeah,
it was often the case. And Harriet is so interesting, and you know, she's, I think, writing poetry. I'm assuming she's writing poetry and not reciting other people's work and asking, you know, which version do you prefer? I think she's kind of writing something in her head, and she's just so, she's so funny with her dad, like, you know, I'm going to tell it to you straight. And she points at the window to indicate that Donna has gone out the window. The whole interactions with the family, I mean, it's kind of weird after reading the final dossier about, to see how that family really fell apart, because in this pilot, they seem so idyllic, you know, like the Palmer family, you can tell that there are strains, but the Hayward family, everything looks hunky-dory. So I think that's an interesting piece of this also to look back on, because it's such a contrast to where apparently this family is headed in the future.
Or isn't, now that Laura Palmer doesn't get murdered.
and right. Like, you know, Lara Flynn Boyle, like, what, 19 when she filmed this, and so good. Like, the, you know, all the abuse and all the other stuff that was heaped on her from, you know, all kinds of things, doesn't even matter when you come back to this. Like, that performance, you know, that's great. That's eternal. It's never going to change. And you know, man, you know, if there is going to be a season four, like, Michael Ancine and Lara Flynn Boyle are still alive. David Lynch, like, do what you got to do, man. Work your magic. Like, you'd like to see them back.
It was so much fun watching this pilot after having completed this entire Twin Peaks series, finally, and after reading all the books that we've been alluding to as well. And I'd never seen the international version, so I was, you know, very intrigued by it and thought it was interesting, kind of an interesting take on how to wrap up the story. You know, there are tons of little things that I'm seeing with a different perspective, like we've all been mentioning. you know, some of those, you know, quickly are the audiovisual components like microphones, public address systems, feedback, the crackle of electricity. And, you know, it's fascinating to see that electricity was sizzling away from the very start. And it's super eerie that a bad transformer in the morgue is the suspected cause of the flickering light. So Energy and Power have been causing trouble all along, and so has Bob. And that's going to be kind of my focus today, is to talk about Bob. Because the big difference between the U.S. pilot for Twin Peaks and the international version is Bob. In the extended section, we glimpse Bob reflected in a mirror. We see a sketch of him. And then we get a full-on confrontation with him in the hospital basement, during which Mike shoots Bob. And before that happens, Bob tells us that Robert is his proper name. And he also asks Cooper about Mike, saying, "I so much want to sing with him again." And with that, the mystery is supposedly wrapped up, as Killer Bob is killed by his former sidekick, Mike. But for those of us who watch the entire series, we know that Bob is really a drifter and had inhabited Leland Palmer, who ultimately killed Laura. I think there are clues throughout the pilot that indicate, even for international audiences, that there's more to Bob than the long-haired dude in the basement, though. you know, in particular, it's no accident that the episode is populated with multiple Bobs. Bobby Briggs is the first Bob that we meet, and he's pretty squirrely. You know, it's interesting to see him this way because he's so different in The Return. You know, he's super squirrely as a teen. He's stepping out with waitress Shelley. He's copping attitude when the police question him about girlfriend Laura's disappearance. His buddy Mike is a total jerk, and they seem to be partners in crime, much like the Bob and Mike in the basement. And then at the Great Northern, we meet another Bob who I'd totally forgotten about. He's an employee of the Great Northern who issues orders to Julie the concierge, while Audrey slowly twists that pencil into a styrofoam cup of coffee. And Julie says, "Okay, Bob," which Audrey then repeats mockingly, saying, "Okay, Bob, okay, Bob, okay," before she asks what would happen if she pulled the pencil out of the cup. And Julie tells her not to, and Audrey then, rebels by releasing the pencil, spilling coffee on Julie's desk. So after a careful rewatch, it's glaringly obvious that although Bob the killer in the basement may be dead, Bob is everywhere in Twin Peaks. He's even this low-key guy at the Great Northern who doesn't want the deal with the Norwegians to get messed up by the news of Laura's murder. Yet simply uttering that Bob's name leads to mischief, as we saw with Audrey. We also find out that there are multiple killer Bobs, too, as James reveals to Donna that Laura said that Bobby had told her that he had killed this guy. And I remember that tidbit sticking out with me for a long time, and it takes forever, seemingly forever, before we get details about that incident of Bobby killing a guy. You know, we get some of it in Laura's diary, and then we get more later in future episodes. But in the context of the pilot, this little clue is another moment where suspicion and death are circling around another Bob, this time Bobby Briggs. And another parallel for Bobby Briggs is that when he's questioned about whether or not he killed Laura Palmer, he says, "So what if I had a fight with her? If I sang songs with her? If I went skipping rope with her?" And it's not necessarily a memorable line at all, but now it jumps out at me more since we had Killer Bob in this episode talking about how he wanted to sing with Mike again. And in the same episode, we see teen Mike and teen Bobby getting into fights and getting into jail together. We're meant to draw these connections and wonder what the future holds for the Twin Peaks youth, especially since we see young Mike screaming at and violently grabbing his girlfriend Donna. It's clear there are many more men to worry about in Twin Peaks, and that the capture of Bob is not going to solve the many lurking problems in the town. So I'd love to hear from all of you about what you make of all the Bobs and Mikes, actually, in this episode. And if you think these are false clues about the killer, leaving viewers to wonder, are they another puzzle for the viewers to solve? Or is it simply a statement that Bob is everywhere, you know, as some kind of universal threat?
I love that notion that all of the bubbling bobs are part of a universal threat, sort of a message that like Bob is woven into the fabric of everything here. And as we know, Twin Peaks is sort of set up as a you know, a model of the small American town. And in so doing, claiming that this, this name, this principle, this concept of Bob, is echoed and repeats. I wonder if all of this Bob and Mike repetition is part of what became other incidents of repetition and duplication that we would see throughout. So, I mean, I wonder if this is like the no budget nascent idea version that became, all of those mailmen and, Candy, Bandy, and Sandy, and so on. I wonder if that is sort of how they started playing with this idea. And, we pretty early on latched onto this notion of multiplicity and sort of what that means when you are seeing people from a different dimension, how the lawman concept gets refracted into that amazing layered profile shot. So I wonder if that was already built in. I would guess yes.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. And I think, we've seen lots of examples of this with names too, right? There were two Chow fonts, for instance, we learned from the visit to the Fat Trout Trailer Park. We've got multiple Bobs and we've got multiple Mikes. And, part of what that does to me is contribute to the sort of dreamlike quality of the whole thing too, right? I mean, something that I think is a common feature of a lot of people's dreams, certainly mine, is the way characters turn into other characters, and it's the same person even though they don't look the same, or it's a different person even though they do look the same. And so the idea of having a bunch of different characters with the same name, I think, is also sort of plays into that same sort of dreamlike, surreal nature to the show.
I would just add real quickly too, you reminded me, Damon, in the international pilot, there's a scene of Cooper recording a message to Diane that's not in the regular pilot. And he says, when two events involving the same case happen simultaneously, we have to pay very close attention. So that's sort of on the level of the case, but he's kind of doing that to us as viewers too. When two things happen that are similar, pay attention.
On, you stole my thunder a little
bit. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. That's exactly what I was going to say. Is like Cooper, like he says that. And I think he actually does say it, like, if not in the pilot episode, then he does like say it again, like really early on in Twin Peaks, the line about like when two separate events occur simultaneously, pertaining to the same object in inquiry, we must always pay strict attention. And he like he might say that in Rocks and Bottles, I think. But clearly that's like a huge theme for like Twin Peaks, that like, McLaughlin is just like, speaking out for us. And Jennifer, like, I think you did a really good job of like, sort of, getting that little bit of dialogue, which I always thought was a little weird from Bobby. Like, why is he talking about jumping rope with Laura? Right? It's like it seems like so weird for him to say. But then, when you kind of like, when Mike in the basement says he wants to sing with Bob again, you're like, like there's Frost and Lynch like tying that together. But, one of the things that like I was kind of thinking about, which is stupid because Bob like spells it out, right? He's like, oh, well, my name is Robert. And I'm like, yeah, fool, I could have figured that out on my own. But it like does like, beg the question, like, because Damon, like, how many letters do we see? Because I know we see the R in Laura's fingernail. There's the T with like Teresa Banks's fingernail. And I think Maddie gets an O. And
B.
I forget
if,
B. Okay.
Yeah.
And like, I forget if like Ronette has one, but you know,
she doesn't.
So, you know, like there's either going to be two or three more of these murders had Cooper not intervened and, you know, Bob was able to get his plan. And, you know, I know kind of the overall narrative of the show like changes, but like, what would have happened with Bob had he, you know, sort of completed his symphony of murder, right? Like, that's always like been a big question of mine that you know, that this, you know, episode kind of got me thinking again, because it's like, well, he doesn't get to spell out his name, or, you know, maybe there are more dead bodies out there with, you know, like, you know, letters under the fingernails that we haven't even seen yet.
I would dredge Pearl Lakes.
Yeah, for sure. You know, because I'm just like, man, there's, you know, there's either more dead bodies out there, or, you know, there's Bob is still, you know, hungry, right?
There's a lot of debate in Twin Peaks fan circles as to how far forward Lynch and Frost were thinking when they sat down to write the pilot for Twin Peaks. And, you know, depending who you listen to, they might have either had no idea what was coming next, with Lynch kind of writing by feel and drawing more or less spontaneously from dreams and visions, or from another camp, you might get the idea that they had a pretty good idea of who the killer was and where they wanted all the characters to end up and sort of what it all means. And they, you know, kind of masterfully crafted this this complex puzzle that everybody is still sort of trying to piece together today. Some folks have even gone so far as to speculate that Lynch and Frost actually planned basically for the show to be canceled and to revisit it 25 years later. Although, you know, I personally have always found that to be a bit of a stretch. As always with these kinds of debates, I think the truth probably lies somewhere in between. But I have to say, after rewatching the pilot episode, especially this European version with the Red Room scene at the end, I'm much more inclined towards the camp that there was indeed always at least a sort of loose master plan. And that at least in certain ways, the show was always intended to end as it ends more or less at the end of season 3. So first, let me say that with the benefit of hindsight, certain things are very evident about the mystery of who killed Laura Palmer. I know I discussed before in a previous episode that, you know, Bobby at Laura's funeral points out that everybody knew that Laura was in trouble. And I talked a little bit about how some of the characters didn't seem very surprised that this had happened. And in this rewatch of the pilot, it was really clear to me that this was maybe most evidently true in the case of her own parents, which, again, with the benefit of hindsight, knowing what we know that Leland was the killer and that Sarah maybe was Judy, that makes a lot of sense. So, you know, the first place that this really jumped out to me was at the very beginning when Sarah was going through this kind of frantic search for Laura and was in this really palpable panic. And, you know, it struck me that there were a lot of very innocuous and frankly, you know, what seemed like they would have been more likely scenarios that could have explained Laura's whereabouts. So, you know, Laura could have been with Bobby. Laura could have gotten a ride with Leland. Those are possible explanations that are offered to Sarah. And, you know, she doesn't calm down at all. To me, it seems like she clearly knows that something is really deeply wrong, even when there's, you know, not really that much reason to think so initially. And Leland likewise seems to have known that Laura was killed before the sheriff says so. I know Jonathan just alluded earlier to the sort of look on his face. But, you know, what's interesting about that scene is that, you know, we know Laura's missing and Leland knows that Laura's missing, and then the sheriff shows up. And so he just immediately knows what happens, right? The sheriff could have been coming to say like, oh, she's in the hospital. She was in a real bad accident, or, you know, we caught her doing drugs behind the high school. But no, like Leland just knows she's dead. And again, knowing what we know, it makes a lot of sense. I also wanted to note here that the very first two scenes that Leland is in, there's also very prominently featured a fire right next to him. And then later when Dr. Hayward is telling Eileen about how Leland is doing, we again see a fire in the background. And so, you know, while some folks have suggested that Lynch and Frost themselves had maybe not settled on who the killer was at this stage, I don't really buy that watching this episode. The clues are already here, and, you know, we can see them pretty clearly with the benefit of hindsight. But what's even more striking to me, especially here in the European pilot, is that we already have the concept of Coop ending up in the Red Room in the distant future, and more specifically, 25 years later. You know, whatever else may have happened in season two that wasn't part of the original plan for Twin Peaks, little Nikki, the notion that Laura would meet Cooper in the Red Room 25 years later was already baked in. It was already there in 1989, just waiting for the payoff that we get in 2017. And what's even more notable is that all those years later, you know, after these amazing 18 episodes of season three, we end up in essentially the same place that we do at the end of this European version of the pilot. So one of the very last images that we see in this version is Laura whispering a secret into Cooper's ear. We talked a couple of weeks ago, and actually earlier today, in Jonathan's segment, about how Lynch and Frost always wanted to leave us with an unsolved and maybe unsolvable mystery. And here, you know, if we assume that the show hadn't been picked up after this, right, that this had been the end, we would get just that. There's no "my father killed me" voiceover. There's just a secret passed from Laura to Cooper that we can't hear, that we don't get to know what it is. And that is exactly what we see at the end of the final episode of The Return as well. Laura is filled with secrets, and it was always supposed to end like this. So there are a lot of parallels and I think pretty apparent sort of call forwards from the pilot episode. You know, I could go on. There's the idea of live performances at the Roadhouse, for instance, which are so important in season three and which get their start here in the pilot with Julie Cruz. But now that we've seen the full story, what else did you notice at the beginning of the story that lays the groundwork for specific scenes or specific features of the show that came much later that, you know, would not have been apparent on a first viewing?
So, you know, first of all, Damon, I'm going to 100% back you in the sense that, like, you know, Frost and Lynch, I think, definitely knew what they were doing. And I mean, a lot of what this pilot episode is doing is sort of establishing the mythology of Twin Peaks. But I think Lynch and Frost themselves have kind of like established sort of their own mythologies, right? Like Lynch is always like, oh, well, you know, I, you know, go by feeling and, you know, we need to have, you know, things that are ambiguous. And I think, you know, Frost has very much been about like, you know, weaving in like, you know, kind of events from American history and, you know, and like it, like into this grand tapestry. But like, I think if you assume that these guys made this show without any sort of plan, you're totally crazy because, you know, all that stuff is there, right? I mean, in the international pilot, like, you know, Bob gives his line about like, I'll find you in my death bag. And, you know, then, you know, like the next time you see me, like I will kill again, right? Which is something they repeat, you know, when we get to Arbitrary Law in, you know, season two, right? Where kind of the whole murder mystery comes to a close. They just like, Lynch and Frost like, nope, this line is great. We're going to save it for the most appropriate time. And so like the notion of the fact that they have kind of like, oh, we're like playing it by ear or, oh, you know, we have mistakes happen that work into it. Like it's half true, right? Because, you know, Jennifer, in your section, I was thinking you make like the point of like the electricity and, you know, in that famous like autopsy scene, right? We all know that like the light was flickering. And, you know, Lynch was like, no, I love it. Right. So, you know, like he incorporates accidents, but yet he takes those accidents and makes them part of like the whole sort of mythology. So I'm like, oh yeah, it's no, you know, coincidence that like the light is flickering where Laura's body is like laying. And, you know, if Laura is the one, yeah, of course we're going to see like all that electricity, you know, spark up and like be crazy. So you know, it's like it's a feat of, I think, both like planning, incorporating accidents, and then sort of like reverse engineering, right? Because when we know the whole story, you know, that accident that Lynch incorporated then makes a hell of a lot more sense now that we see it sort of in its final form. And so, you know, if people are out there thinking that like they just kind of like played it by ear, yeah, I think so, right? It's funny because we see Major Briggs here too with like no hint whatsoever of like how important that character is going to become. He's almost like a non-entity, right? Like Bobby brushes him off and he doesn't even say anything when we first see him in their home there. So yeah, like that was to me like a lot of the fun of this was just like, you know, like trying to figure out, okay, Lynch and Frost, you know, you think you're so much smarter than everyone else, but we got all the pieces right here and we can kind of, you know, like play this game too with you guys, right? So, which is, I think to me, like one of the endless appeals of Twin Peaks is that, you know, you're never going to get 100% the straight answer, but there's a lot of like breadcrumbs that you can use to make your own theories.
It's so much fun to watch the pilot again after going on the unbelievably vast journey that season three takes us on. And, you know, I'm remembering back to rewatching the pilot again, you know, recently and feeling so excited and intrigued and tantalized. And, you know, when we watched the pilot for the first time, we really had no idea where this would go. It could have been a much more grounded show and still been awesome. But I don't think, there would be no way to predict how far, how deep, how serious the show became, you know? And so I really wonder, you know, I'm so curious about how much Lynch and Frost really had mapped out and how much, you know, was sort of this string of happy accidents. I will say that, you know, we do see some technique things that continue to be important, like showing the stoplight. And Damon, I think you are right on the money saying that, like, you know, these pauses on inanimate objects give our brains a moment to think. And that actually gets to my answer to you, one of my answers to your question, which is that I think what we see, if we're looking carefully with perfect hindsight, or, you know, as perfect as it gets in the Lynchverse, is that already in this episode, Lynch and Frost are playing on our nervous system. I said at one point that the canvas on which they're telling their story is not television, but is instead like our nervous systems. And, you know, Lynch is already playing these tricks and tweaking us and getting us to react on a very deep level. The other thing that I would say that we see from the very first episode, which is really important, are these tropes of abuse. We see it in Leo. We recognize it. We have this potentially systemic message about Bob and so on. And that is actually going to be, it is going to develop beyond just the usual thriller trope, and it's going to become this big discourse, this very meaningful statement that runs throughout the whole project, I think.
Yeah, I think also, you know, watching this episode, there was a lot of groundwork established for dysfunctional relationships. So, like, certainly for abuse, you know, we see Leo acting horribly. We see Mike acting horribly to Donna, which I'd sort of forgotten about, just how violent he was. And that was really terrible to see. And it's interesting. There's a scene with Donna, with Big Ed, and Mike drives up in his car and he's like, you know, what are you doing? You need to be at the police station, you know, supporting Bobby. And Ed's just like, whoa, like, you know, get the hell out of here. And after Mike leaves, Big Ed says, or no, Donna says something like, oh, one of them says to the other, I know how to pick them. And the other one like repeats that because Nadine is also in the background yelling at Ed, you know, because she's in that phase of being, you know, very emotionally abusive to him. And so both of them are basically kind of consoling each other, like, yeah, we're in these bad relationships. So that, I think, was a prominent theme. And then, you know, I mentioned electricity, which like really jumped out at me with the flickering lights. And then we've got, you know, things with feedback and microphones. Maybe I'll talk more about that next week when we're theorizing our big theories. But also something that has been itching at me for a while is numbers. And I know that 10 is important. And we have 361 on Mike's jacket, which adds up to 10. So nice. I feel like there's there are these numeric clues throughout that I need to put on my wall serial killer map.
Conspiracy yarn.
My conspiracy yarn. Yeah. So I think that, yeah, they're already sticking in these little, yeah, breadcrumbs, somebody said earlier. The breadcrumbs are there. Oh, and another thing I noticed was that the letter that Bob placed under the finger was under the ring finger. And we don't talk about rings in this episode, but rings become very important later. The gold ring, the jade ring. The ring is very important to Bob, very important to all these supernatural elements. So the fact that the number is placed, you know, under the nail of the person's ring finger, I think is also significant.
And Cooper is wearing a pinky ring in this, I noticed. I'm like I never, like you know, is he some sort of Goomba out there from like the ghost? Like, I'm like, it's right on his finger. It's so crazy.
That brings us to the twist, and today I thought we should talk about a scene that we haven't discussed yet. In the international version of the pilot, there's a scene with Lucy and Andy at home, at Lucy's house, and Lucy is in kind of a 1940s feeling dressing gown, looking pretty glamorous, playing with a paddle ball that has one of those rubber balls on it. And Andy is playing the trumpet. And then, you know, they're interrupted at bedtime. As Lucy points out, you know, we're interrupted at bedtime by this phone call, you know, that has to do with this ongoing investigation. So I'd love to hear from all of you your reactions to this little vignette, seeing Lucy and Andy at home at bedtime.
So two things that immediately jumped out to me. One is that, it's hard to tell because he plays so poorly, but Andy is actually playing taps, which is, of course, you know, at like a scout camp or whatever, what gets played before bedtime, which is really the only indication that it's bedtime as far as he goes, because he's like fully dressed in this hideous, like plaid blazer. But, you know, the other thing we were talking in my segment about sort of like calls forward from the pilot. And, you know, what this showed to me was like an early slice of like domestic life for Andy and Lucy. And, you know, since we know that they end up, you know, married with a kid, you know, getting to see them like at home together in this, at this early stage of the show kind of gives us a glance forward into what's coming for them.
I loved it, first of all. And like, and in fact, I think if like you were to ask like Lynch and Frost, like, you know, 30 years later, what scene do Twin Peaks fans find like, or at least the four of us anyways, like find like, you know, I'm sure they probably would have banked on like some of the Bob stuff, but no, it's, you know, Andy and Lucy at home here. And because it felt the most true, right? I mean, it's like, oh, okay. Now I get how, like, you know, Lucy plus Andy equals a kid that thinks he's Marlon Brando and, like, you know, pulls on like that whole act. And like, the only thing I kind of wish was that like Lucy was like perfectly doing the paddleball, because, you know, I've played with those things a few times and you're like, oh, this is going to be the time I like master it and like get it right. But I don't know if I've ever seen anybody like just, you know, get the paddleball perfect. So that would have been a, you know, neat little detail to get in there. And then I was also really struck by the fact where they say, oh, well, Hawk does the drawings, when in the show it's you know, Andy is the artist, right? So, you know, that got me thinking of like all kinds of like, you know, alternate stuff, which maybe we might come back to, but I'll let, you know, maybe Colin speak of it first here, but yeah, it's truly like a different universe, because, you know, Hawk is not the artist, it's Andy who makes that sketch of Bob. And like, I also want to know if like the sketch of like the false Bob that like they're like, no, was like somebody on the set or like somebody important who is so I'm like, oh, I gotta find that out at one point or another. But yeah, totally loved seeing Andy and Lucy at home, and just like, yep, these two weirdos would definitely make another weirdo baby. 100%.
Can I say one thing real quick? When Cooper is describing his dream that, you know, they use the pieces of the, you know, to create later, when he's describing his dream to Sheriff Truman over breakfast, he says that Hawk did the sketch.
Ah, so maybe he's like, Hawk did the sketch in the dream, and that's what Cooper is remembering. Okay.
See, this is great. No wonder I love this scene, because this justifies my confusion. Back when we got to that episode, I would have sworn that it was Hawk who did the sketch. And like, you could go back and listen to my confusion on our podcast. And so clearly what was happening was that I was just vibing through to an alternate universe. And you guys were talking to, like, you know, Universe 313 Colin. And, you know, that was what happened there. I love this scene. It's one of the ones that projects something that's going to happen. It's one of the ones that says, oh, not only is this show weird, but it's silly. And it evokes the lovability that we are going to see in so many ways down the road. Now, sometimes that goes off the rails a bit, but, you know, in my imagination, Lucy and Andy are practicing for like a talent show or something. Like, how, you know, how do you make this make sense? And that kind of silliness built into it, when it works in Twin Peaks across the whole span of things, it really is lovely. And this little vignette, you know, I recognize that it may not be canon, but it may be canon in my heart.
And like, Lucy and Andy end up being like the two biggest heroes in the show. I mean, because like, Andy, like, you know, gets taken up to see the fireman, and Lucy shoots Bob. So it's like, it just goes to show that like, heroism can come from like, you know, the silliest of origins.
Yeah. I mean, I think it really is an important scene. And I mean, I was left wondering why this was the only time that we saw them at home. And should we have seen more? You know, I would have loved to have seen, you know, some kind of spinoff, or, you know, or more episodes with them at home. But it's interesting. Like, there are a lot of characters that we don't really see at home. Like, that's one of the mysteries on Twin Peaks, is that these interior lives are often not displayed on the show. So I think we're really lucky that we get to have it in this international version. But it would have been fun to see a lot more. Well, friends, that brings us to the end once again, likely leaving you with many more questions than answers, as is regularly the case on Twin Peaks. I know that my mind reels thinking about all the different ways that Twin Peaks concludes depending upon the episode you are watching. And as is the case with the show, the end isn't really the end for us here at Back to the Double R either. We've grown so fond of the lovely denizens of Twin Peaks, like Lucy and Andy, that we will be back for more. Next week, we have a special episode plan in which we will hash out some closing thoughts about Twin Peaks and ruminate on theories about what it all means. Following that episode, we will be moving to a monthly podcast, digging into not only more about Twin Peaks, but also discussing projects in the broader and related universe of David Lynch and more. If you have suggestions for topics we should discuss, including books and critical perspectives on Twin Peaks, do let us know. We love hearing from our listeners on our socials and through email at backtothedoubler@gmail.com. And also keep checking back on our website, backtothedoubler.com, to see all of our episodes, our bonus posts, and Jonathan's incredible art. Thanks once again to Silencio for allowing us to feature their music each week on our podcast. On behalf of my co-hosts Colin, Damon, and Jonathan, we'll see you again next week.